Welcome to Module 5. Our goal in this module is to introduce doubt into the storyline of our shame. As you went through the first few modules, you may have already noticed that your shame and core beliefs function under absolutes of yes and no, all or nothing. There's an extreme sense of rigidity in this, and over time, the bubble of bad, unsafe, wrong continues to expand more and more. To begin the doubt process, we'll walk through a series of steps outlined for you in this worksheet that you'll download below this video. First, we need to consider, for each of the rules that we've defined, are they specific to you or are they universal? Meaning, are the rules you listed ones that only you have to follow, or are they a social construct or norm that everyone else must follow too? Rules specific to us are automatically labeled as shame-based rules, and the doubt is introduced at that. Why are the rules different for me? Am I honestly at the greatest deficit in terms of worth and value, or at the highest risk in terms of my shame? Now, we started to look at this a bit in Module 1 as you looked at your core beliefs. In this module, we'll go a bit deeper and look at each of the rules and ask ourselves the same question. Now, I do want to point out one radical acceptance point here. There will be some rules that fall somewhere in the middle. They may be true or accepted as such for a group or subset of people based on their intersecting identities. So, for example, there may be rules or expectations for a Hispanic person who identifies as transgender or a Latinx person in a fat body. They're not specific to you, but they are specific to an identity that you might share. These rules are still shame-based. The system is different for a portion of the population. People are made to think that they're less than due to an aspect of themselves. Mark these rules as shame-based as well. That being said, we must be diligent in looking for the ways systemic oppression has infiltrated our rulebook. Again, considering roles and responsibilities, I can see many different rules internalized about how I need to exist in the world to make up for a one-down identity, as it's often referred to. Naming this is both important and overwhelming. For the scope of this program, we'll be exploring the work we can do in our own lives to try and let go of these rules and pressures where and when it's safe, something we will definitely explore more over time. And we're not going to be able to dive into dismantling all or the entirety of these latter systems. These systems can and need to be changed from a global and political level all the way down to an individual level. They're just extending beyond the work we're able to do here in this course. So one book I'm going to suggest reading to dive a little bit deeper into this and increase awareness of some of these systems is Sonia Renee Taylor's The Body Is Not an Apology. Her teachings align in so many ways with the work we're doing here, but in relation to the more systemic impact of a culture of isms and oppression and what that's done to all of us. I'll be sure to put a link to this book below this video for you in case this is something that you want to take a break from this program to work on or want to come back to later on. The next step we'll take is to find the source. From where was this rule birthed? Over time, and the more we peel back these layers and get clear on our shame, the more we see that, till now, we are not the ones who've authored our story. Whether it be our parents or caregivers, childhood friends, a toxic relationship, or crappy work environments, our story has been penned by many authors that have stripped us of the opportunity to create a story in which we're not without, less than, or bothered. This leads us to overinflate our role and importance in everyone else's story as we filter everything through the lens of our own shame. From ruminating on what we assume people are thinking and saying about us, interpreting someone's action or inaction as personal, or assuming ill or malicious intent from others, everything becomes connected to us in a way that furthers the storyline we're somehow the problem and solution in everyone else's life. The overinflation of our role and responsibility leads to a deeper pressure to perform and an inability to trust in and be vulnerable and authentic in our connections. So in your worksheet, you're going to consider where these rules came from. What early interactions and experiences laid the foundation for this? And once we name the author, we need to ask ourselves if this is the person or the experience we want to hang our whole story on. Do I want to make that person the primary author of my memoir? Do I trust them to create an objective and inclusive rulebook from which we can all play? Is there anything that would stop them from being able to do that? And how has their impact on my story resulted from the shame and pain they've held on to from their own story? Now, in many instances, it's going to feel hard to name the exact person or experience from which a rule is developed. We often find ourselves using words like they, no one, or everyone to describe rules or ideas of how we need to show up. But we couldn't tell you who those exact people are. They will think X. They won't like me. No one will take me seriously unless. This is a product of normalization, having repeated or deepened a belief so much so that it's been assumed to be true at a universal level. But this is still informed by our own limiting experience and is not a universal truth. So for some, a high school education for many people may be seen at the same level of success as others view a doctorate. For many, having a six-figure job and checking the boxes of 3 kids, 2 dogs, 1.5 baths, and 8,000 square foot home is happiness. And for others, living in a 1,200 square foot home with a multi-generational family, working at a nonprofit, making $25,000 a year to help support the family and focus on togetherness is what success and fulfillment is all about. So when we feel resistance and rigidity form around a rule, go back to question one and ask yourself if this rule fits for everyone. Is this an aspiration everyone wants or aspires to? Would the context ever make sense if it were different for someone else? And what might it mean if this was just one possibility of living or being, but not the only way? Can you only be happy if you're a size 2? I mean, I know many people who are a size 2 who are miserable. Can making 6 figures or more a year give you inner peace? In fact, we actually know higher earning can also correlate with increased mental health issues, including suicide. The rules give you an idea of what life could be like, but they're not the only way. So again, where did these ideas come from? And even if you can't name the writer, who around you has internalized those same beliefs and pressures as well? Now, step 3 is to consider if you agree with these rules. How do you feel about it if we phrase the rule as people need to or everyone should blank? So for example, I would label myself a recovering perfectionist. I struggle with the idea that I have to be perfect all the time to be worthy. This shows up at home with such intense shame. I can struggle to open the refrigerator when food goes bad because I should have, quotes, been able to manage it better. This happens at work when I get a negative review, miss out on an opportunity, or feel like I bombed with a client. It even happens on vacation when I make a plan I'll assume that would be really fun for everyone and then something doesn't work out. To my core, I have this narrative that I have to be perfect for everyone all the time. But if I ask myself, do I agree with the notion that someone should have to be perfect to be liked? Absolutely not. And even when I reframe it back to myself, I don't like the idea of having to be perfect to be liked. I disagree with the notion that perfection is an ideal to chase, and I don't want to be a part of perpetuating systems of anxiety that drive people to feel this way. Sure, my actions might sometimes still line up with these pressures or beliefs, and we'll talk more about the differentiation of thought or belief from action in later phases. But I do disagree with it at its core. This is a huge place of empowerment. By differentiating the pressure we feel or the rule that has been written from our attitude towards it, we create space to introduce doubt. The last two questions are my favorite and arguably lead to some of the greatest distress and insights. The first is to consider who you become when you follow these rules or oblige these systems. How does it change how you engage or show up in the world? Are you okay with this? Do you like it? Is this person a performance version of you, fully and truly? This question aims to begin to identify how shame leads us to perform, and that for many of us, even if we're stuck in that performance, we may not like that version of ourselves. Or even if we do like aspects of it, we can become overwhelmed by it. For example, I don't like how my shame has driven home in me the belief that I have to be right or have the answers all the time. The idea isn't about wanting to put others down or make them feel less. In fact, it has nothing to do with them. I just should know everything and always handle situations the right way. But the impact of this is that it disrupts my ability to be vulnerable with others. I have a hard time being a learner instead of feeling like I have to have the answer, which makes taking feedback really difficult. I struggle if I feel like I got it wrong and someone else saw and can become defensive and sometimes hurtful of others to protect myself from feeling the pain of being seen in such a way. Again, on some level, I may still feel like I have to do or be this way. And how could I not if this is what I've been made to feel by my shame over these years? But I don't like it. It's not fulfilling and it prioritizes things I don't value, putting myself above others rather than being vulnerable, open, and kind. And the last question to consider is, what's the cost? What does it cost you in terms of time, money, and energy to keep up with these rules? We've already started to define this in the other reflection questions, and we can see how the overall impact on our time and energy is drastic and often puts us at odds with living authentically and in line with our values. In some cases, the cost of being or doing X is worth the hefty payout. For example, this program is by no means a low-budget item on any of the three fronts. And if the investment is in line with your goals and values, it's a worthwhile expense. But as you look back over the other reflection questions and consider the impact living under these rules has had on you, my guess is we'll find that this is not a worthwhile expense. Now, be kind to yourself. When people get to this step, they feel a mounting pressure to cut ties with their shame and stop doing this. They feel a sense of motivation and urgency start to bubble up under the surface and want to change right now. Harness that energy, absolutely. But remind yourself this program will get you there at the pace that allows for meaningful and sustainable change. Do not succumb to the pressures to pick up a Band-Aid solution. Trying to do it all right now is just a backhanded way of shame trying to keep you feeling stuck. You'll go all in at high charge, get overwhelmed, feel ill-prepared, and reverb right back to where we started. Allow yourself to feel that excitement if and when it arrives. Celebrate it, feel it fully, then remind yourself to walk it back. We're going to get there. We're just making sure we do it in a way that isn't secretly cloaked in shame. Now, two final things before we get started. There are two shame games that I really want to make sure that we point out and spend some time considering. The first, your brain will likely have a hard time believing that any of these rules wouldn't be true for you. Sure, you may know it on some level logically, but you may not believe it. That's because the rules are tied to these innermost beliefs of the self, and it feels like letting go of them would mean exposing yourself as unworthy and unlovable. That's okay. If that happens, simply notice it, reflect on it, take a minute to notice the difference between knowing and believing. Sometimes that discrepancy causes even more distress as we know something to be true and yet feel stuck in a fear. I know that when I watched the newest season of Stranger Things, season 4, that Vecna, this terrifying demon in the show, isn't real and that I wasn't in danger of being attacked by a Dungeons and Dragons character. But my fear brain had a hard time believing that when I went to bed after a particularly scary episode. Sure, logically, it's frustrating to have my sleep interrupted by something I legitimately know isn't true. But remember, fear only works in absolutes. So considering the danger the show alluded to, it would kind of make sense that my fear brain, when faced with the choice of saying safe or unsafe, would label the swirling thoughts and imagery surrounding this as unsafe and as such elicit that sort of hypervigilant response. So be kind to yourself as this comes up and try and remind yourself that your fear and shame brain are trying to protect you. Note where the resistance to accepting or allowing doubt to exist occurs, and we'll make space to come back to this as we move through the program. One thing that helps me if I see this coming up in my own reflections is removing myself from the equation. As we've talked about, when the rules and beliefs we hold are rooted in shame, they'll be specific to us and what we must do or how we must act or present to be worthy. Instead, imagine we're exploring the rulebook of a loved one, a friend, your child, a partner. Does that change how you experience the rules or your ability to introduce doubt? The second shame game, which in many ways connects to the first, is that you may notice a flooding of proof stories that come in as we try to do this. You might return to the proof stories we outlined in Module 2 or find new proof stories emerging. Remember that time? Or, yeah, but we really have to consider blank. It can feel incredibly frustrating when you can feel your brain at odds with itself, wanting to let go of these notions and yet digging your nails in deeper with each yeah, but. Part of the problem is that our brains are wired to react more intensely and hold on to negative experiences with greater activation and intensity. Have you ever had a review where you got tons of great feedback and accolades and, I don't know, all sorts of positive things, but left only thinking about one area for improvement? Or have you had a great vacation with your friend or partner, but you had one fight along the way? And that seems to be the thing that's sticking with you. Now, there's protection in this, as negative experiences can be synonymous with threats and exposures. I'm not asking you to let go of those memories, only to consider that some details may be amplified out of context. As easily as you can remember a time something bad happened, there are likely exponentially greater times something neutral or good happened in similar circumstances. But because it isn't a negative or shame-proving experience, we've just let it go for ease of continuing in the storyline. And because your fear brain is always in the background saying, yeah, but are you sure? We shouldn't chance it. Shouldn't let that go. We should hold on to this fear just in case. This may be annoying or lonely or difficult, but at least it's safe, right? That's what fear wants. So when you notice yourself only coming up with evidence to support your shame, consider how your shame brain has rewired your brain and might be affecting you, and try one of the following. First, ask yourself, what am I afraid of? Go back to module 4 and consider the consequences at stake. This will give us a lot of insight into why we may hold on to things more intensely. Might also help us identify thoughts or rules where the consequences may be lower and a more accessible place to introduce doubt into the mix. 2, take yourself out of the equation. Consider how the consequences may look different for others, if any exist. Notice when others haven't lived up to the rule, or even how the rule doesn't seem to apply to them, and how this may allow the possibility it is purely a shame rule, as the consequence and impact seems specific to you. And finally, ask someone else for support. Share with them what you're working on and talk to them about the rules that you're getting caught in. Ask them if they've ever had a time they didn't live up to this rule or exhibit X and what happened, or if they've been around you when you haven't met the expectations of perfection that's been outlined by your shame, and how has it impacted the way that they see you. Now, this is a really great time and space to use the discussion forum and share where you get stuck. One, because getting things out of your head is incredibly helpful, but two, we can connect with others in this program who may have felt the same or have similar rules for themselves, and we can learn about how they're working through it, or at a minimum, it's a way to bring back some light onto the shadows of your shame, as telling someone about shame is one of the primary anecdotes. Now, with that, we are a wrap on All Things Module 5, and as you can tell, this one's a bit of a beast. So I really want to make sure that you take that time for celebration and self-care before and after you do this work and along the way wherever you need it. And when you're ready, I will see you back here for our final module of Phase 2, Part A, Module 6.